For details. And that does it for our show. The warmest of congratulations to Chirina Nadura and Hector Rios on the birth of Amihan Rios Nadura. Amihan, welcome to the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm. Under schedule.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
Today, we have a new and in-depth conversation with Dr. Gerald Horn. We speak with him about the latest in the murder of Malcolm X, the trials going on now in the United States that reflect the state of race relations in the United States, from Charlottesville to Kyle Rittenhouse to Ahmaud Arbery, and reparatory justice. What does the global North owe to the global South and to communities that are the South within the North? U.S.-China relations, and much more. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated, so on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The House of Representatives has approved the Build Back Better legislation of social and climate programs. Every Democrat but one voted for it. No Republicans did. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy delayed passage last night when he launched an 8.5-hour speech against the measure, setting a new record for the length of a House speech.
You know, when I look at this bill, it angers me. We are so better than this. You are spending so much money. Never before we spent less defeating Hitler, Mussolini, and Japan than you're spending tonight. We spent less, but it cost us lives. And you're celebrating it.
McCarthy's lengthy speech pushed the final vote to this morning. but couldn't change the outcome. The 2,100-page bill's initiatives include bolstering child care assistance, creating free preschool, curbing seniors' prescription drug costs, and beefing up efforts to slow climate change. Also included are tax credits to spur clean energy development, child care assistance, and extended tax breaks for millions of families with children, lower-earning workers, and people buying private health insurance. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi closed debate on the $1.85 trillion bill, describing it as historic.
That is historic, transformative, and larger than anything we have ever done before. We are building back better. If you are a parent, a senior, a child, a worker, if you are an American, this bill's for you.
Pelosi contrasted the legislation to the $2 trillion Republican tax cut approved under former President Trump, the majority of whose benefits flowed to corporations and the wealthy. Passage in the House sends the legislation to an uncertain future in the Senate. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has promised a vote before Christmas. The Senate is stalled on moving forward on a final vote on the whopping $778 billion military spending policy bill. The bill's being held up not because of its cost, but because Republicans wanted to add amendments on issues like limiting imports of goods produced in China by forced labor and barring payments to migrants who were separated from their children at the border. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren took aim at the record spending for the military, more than under former President Trump, and even more than the Biden administration asked for. She contrasted the glide path for military spending to the hard slog in passing the social programs in the Build Back Better legislation.
Congress keeps the spigot of cash wide open so long as it's for defense. Meanwhile, do you know how much money the president's Build Back Better plan will cost on average each year if Congress passes it? $175 billion. That is about one-fifth the size of this defense bill. When we want to make investments that directly benefit people across this country, we're told that costs too much or that's socialism. But when we spend nearly five times that amount of money in the defense bill, it is just a shrug of the shoulders.
Defense attorneys for the three men accused of killing black jogger Ahmaud Arbery rested their case after calling a total of seven witnesses. Those who testified included Travis McMichael, who fatally shot Arbery. Six neighbors testified about their concerns regarding crime in the neighborhood. McMichael and his father, Greg, armed themselves and pursued the 25-year-old Arbery in a pickup truck. A neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the chase in his own truck and recorded cell phone video. All the defendants are white. 11 of the 12 jurors are white as well. By the end of the day, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may recommend the use of booster vaccines for all adults. An advisory committee to the CDC meets this morning. Even before that this morning, the Food and Drug Administration recommended booster doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. At least 17 states, led by California, have recommended all adults receive a booster if they're at least 6 months out from their two-dose Moderna or Pfizer vaccines or 2 months after their J&J inoculation. The focus on boosters comes as a surge in COVID-19 cases in the upper Midwest has some Michigan schools keeping students at home ahead of Thanksgiving. In Minnesota, the military is sending medical teams to relieve hospital staffs overwhelmed by patients. The World Health Organization has in vain urged wealthy nations to hold off on booster doses for their general populations, while many poor countries still lack the doses to give their people a first shot. Austria's chancellor has ordered his country into a full national lockdown beginning Monday to contain a fourth wave of coronavirus cases. I'm Eileen Alfandari for Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And today we are very fortunate, despite our technical difficulties here, to have Dr. Gerald Horn with us. We're doing an in-depth one-hour special with Dr. Horn. We haven't done that in a while, so this is brand new information. And Dr. Horn, let me welcome you, and then I'll introduce the first section that we'll be discussing, the latest about the assassination of Malcolm X. So, Dr. Gerald Horn is the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books. His most recently published book is The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. He is also the author of The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. He is an award-winning author, and Dr. Horn, you were also granted Ida B. Wells and Czech Antijok Award for Outstanding Scholarship and Leadership in Africana Studies, along with the latest American Book Award that you have won. So, Dr. Horn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so just to refresh our memory here for our listeners, on February 19, 1965, Malcolm X told interviewer Gordon Parks that he was being undermined. On February 21, 1965, he was preparing to address the Organization of African American Unity in Manhattan's Audubon Ballroom in Harlem when someone in the 400-person audience yelled, "Get your hand out of my pocket." As Malcolm X and his bodyguards tried to stop the disruption, a man rushed forward to stop him, once in the chest with a sawed-off shotgun, and then two other men ran to the stage firing semi-automatic handguns, and Malcolm X sadly was pronounced dead at 3:30 p.m. shortly after he arrived at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. Now, all of this took place in front of his family. Let's go to a clip now from BBC about this latest breaking news. Not a surprise to some of us, but certainly a surprise to many around the nation and around the world. Let's go to that clip now.
A senior U.S. prosecutor says two men convicted of the murder in 1965 of the American civil rights leader Malcolm X are to have their convictions quashed. The Manhattan district attorney said Muhammad A. Aziz and Khalil Islam, who spent decades in prison for the killing, did not get the justice they deserved, Arun Iyengar reports.
And the fire hit the window and it woke up my second oldest baby.
Malcolm X, a charismatic advocate for black empowerment, he was 39 when he was killed, shot dead in a New York City ballroom in front of his family. He was the public face of the Nation of Islam. Muhammad al-Aziz and Khalil Islam, along with a third man, Thomas Hagen, were convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. Islam died in 2009. Now, prosecutor Cyrus Vance says the FBI and police withheld information that could have led to the acquittal of Aziz and Islam. The Netflix documentary series Who Killed Malcolm X brought to light some of this evidence.
This evidence was hiding in plain sight all these years, for decades. Much of what we revealed in the documentary was known. Much of it was public, particularly the Manning Marable biography, Life of Reinvention. Even the autobiography of Malcolm X, you know, had kernels of evidence, and the FBI had a treasure trove of documents that we were able to uncover through the Freedom of Information Act that led us down this path.
Prosecutor Vance has also tweeted that more information is likely to be revealed. He's apologized on behalf of the law enforcement agencies to the families of Aziz and Islam. Earlier this year, Malcolm X's daughters added their voices to calls to reopen the investigation in the light of new evidence. It's a cause Malcolm X himself might have strongly argued for. Aruna Iyengar, BBC News.
You know, Dr. Horn, I'm looking at an article that says the exoneration of these two raises even more questions around the assassination of Malcolm X, and clearly there was no physical evidence that connected Mr. Aziz or Mr. Islam to the assassination. They spent so much time in prison, and meanwhile, the man who did confess, he went by the name of Thomas Hagan or Talmadge Hare have early said that the other two were not part of it and others were. And Manning Marrabill, the late Manning Marrabill, in his book about Malcolm X, he certainly alluded to it. And as you heard in the clip, it took this Netflix documentary to get Cyrus Vance and, you know, to open this investigation. But many, for many years, have been clamoring for an investigation. And even now, Gerald Horn, there's still a lot more that I certainly believe still needs to come out, as do many people. Your thoughts on all of this, including the FBI agents who were in the room when Malcolm was assassinated?
Well, you and the clip are correct to point to the fact that Manny Marrabill, in his Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Malcolm X, raised serious and searching questions as to whether or not the real culprits had been captured, and that the men who have just been released were likely innocent. I should also mention another Pulitzer Prize winning book, this one out in the last year or so, by the late New York Newsday reporter Les Payne, which raised the same question. I guess one lesson from this episode is the power of film, because these books notwithstanding, it took a Netflix film, Who Killed Malcolm X, to get investigators, particularly in Manhattan in the district attorney's office, led by Cyrus Vance, to get off their duffs and begin a serious investigation. I say begin a serious investigation because the trail has grown cold. This assassination took place in 1965. Since then, many witnesses have died. Since then, apparently, evidence has been lost, including one of the weapons that was used in the assassination. Serious questions remain, however, and it seems to me they can be put in three buckets. One is concerning the role of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, under the late director, J. Edgar Hoover, who apparently did not reveal evidence to the prosecution about agents of his agency who had penetrated to the highest levels of Malcolm X's organization and retinue. Secondly, one could say the same thing about the New York Police Department. We know that there was an NYPD agent in the front row who was a witness to the assassination. Of course, he was not known as a NYPD agent. He was seen as a reliable member of the Malcolm X entourage. He apparently was able to look the assassins in the face. And yet he was not necessarily interrogated or brought to bear with regard to these men who were unjustly convicted. And then finally, of course, there is the role of the organization that Malcolm X had broken from circa 1963, circa 1964, speaking of the Nation of Islam, who were not very happy about some of the charges that Malcolm had made about the leadership of the Nation of Islam. And it's apparent that one of the men who we can point the finger of accusation at, per the Marrabill biography, the Les Payne biography, and the Netflix movie, a man once known as William Bradley, who appears, at least visually, in the Netflix movie, and of course had ties to the Nation of Islam, and interestingly enough, had ties to the New Jersey Democratic Party establishment. You might recall from the Netflix movie that Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey speaks fondly of Mr. Bradley, who apparently was a community leader of sorts in New Jersey. So many questions are lingering, many questions remain, but the title of the Netflix movie, Who Killed Malcolm X, that question may never be answered authoritatively.
Yeah, and you know, Dr. Horn, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of people are concerned about the charges that Malcolm made before he was killed, when he said they're members of the nations of the Nation of Islam threatening me, that are after me, his home was firebombed, etc., because understandably a lot of black people are protective of movements within the black community, including the Nation of Islam, including Minister Farrakhan and other higher up in the Nation of Islam. And there are others who believe that people were being used, that the FBI also, as part of their whole COINTELPRO operation, were part of orchestrating a lot of this. Now, Cyrus Vance, you know, he's saying, well, in their, you know, the investigation they did, they have not uncovered that there was some plot by the FBI to assassinate Malcolm X. But, you know, to me, that really doesn't hold a smell test. I mean, clearly, it seems as though a number of people who were involved with this Nation of Islam mosque in New Jersey played some role in it, including the man that you just mentioned, Mr. Bradley, and who then became somewhat of a community. The late, he's passed away now, as many people have passed away. So you're right, it does beg the question of, will we ever really know? Because there's been so much redacted, and the idea that the shotgun that was used somehow is lost. How could that have happened? I mean, Malcolm had 21 bullets in him, you know what I mean? in a packed ballroom, and not one, but likely more than one FBI agent in the room at the time, and the FBI withholding evidence that they had and not sharing it with the investigative team at the time in Manhattan. So just some thoughts on this, and also your thoughts on why you think Malcolm became such a threat, because we know that the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, he was very concerned about the possibility of a quote-unquote black messiah, and it seemed as though when Malcolm was preaching separatism, right, he was less of a threat. But when he went to Mecca and he came back and he started building his organization, he became an internationalist, visiting Africa, saying that he'll work with anybody who wants to fight for freedom while maintaining his base of black autonomy, that they saw the possibility that he could really bring people together and become what they saw as a threat to the status quo. Dr. Horn.
Well, certainly with regard to the ongoing investigation, I think we need to pressure the FBI to release more documents. And with regard to the documents that they have released, they have been redacted. That is to say, oftentimes entire paragraphs have been blotted out. We need Congress to pressure the FBI to not only release more documents, but to remove those redactions, which prevent a fuller comprehension of what went on in Manhattan in February 1965 when Malcolm X was killed. And plus, we also know that this killing of Malcolm X is, in some ways, is similar to other killings of the tumultuous 1960s. Recall the recently released movie Judas and the Black Messiah, which recounts the slaying in his bed of Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton on December 4th, 1969. We know that once again, agents of the state had penetrated to the highest level of the Fred Hampton entourage and had assisted the authorities in terms of this Chicago police slaying on December 4th, 1969. We also have the unfortunate example of the killing of Martin Luther King. Recall that about a decade or so after the King killing in 1968, Congressman Lewis Stokes of Cleveland and the Congressional Black Caucus did a congressional investigation that raised very serious and searching questions about the role of the state in the King assassination, and suggested that James Earl Ray, who was fingered for the killing, was probably part of a larger conspiracy. Recall that there are still lingering questions as to how James Earl Ray was able to get out of the United States, apparently was headed to the minority state, the white racist state of Rhodesia, before he was captured. And I should also mention, with regard to Malcolm X, that in the year before his assassination, he had not only gone to Mecca, he had, of course, gone to Africa and had toured Africa. And what's interesting about that is that while he was in Africa, he apparently was subjected to some sort of dirty tricks. Apparently, he was subjected to food poisoning. There is a notorious U.S. agent, black American, by the name of Leo Millas, M-I-L-A-S, who was popping up repeatedly as Malcolm X was traveling throughout Africa. In fact, there is evidence for any who are interested in tracking this down in my book, White Supremacy Confronted, which deals with the U.S. role in backing minority regimes, including apartheid, up to Nelson Mandela's election in 1994. We need records released about Leo Millas, because that may also point to the complicity not only of the NYPD and the FBI, but perhaps of the Central Intelligence Agency as well.
Yeah, and on February 20th, 2021, a day before the 56th anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination, members of his family publicized a letter written by a deceased police officer saying that the New York Police Department and FBI orchestrated his murder. Now, as you say, we may never know. The letter was attributed to a former undercover NYPD officer named Raymond Wood, and his letter stated that he had been pressured by his superiors in NYPD to lure two members of Malcolm X's security team into committing crimes that resulted in their arrest just days before the fatal shooting. So, you know, they weren't around, but there were some others who were. And the people who are just joining us who may not know the news yet, on Thursday, November 19th, two men convicted of the assassination of Malcolm X were exonerated in a court hearing. New York County Supreme Court Administrative Judge Ellen Bylin granted the motion to vacate the convictions of Muhammad A. Aziz and the late Khalil Islam. And for people who are a little not quite following the names, they were formerly known as Norman 3X Butler and Thomas 15X. So, Gerald, we have some new information, but it seems to me as though it answers some questions, but in so many ways it raises more questions than it actually answers. And clearly, the powers that be considered Malcolm X, as they considered Chairman Fred Hampton, whom they also assassinated, to be threats to the status quo and the possibility of building mass movements that they saw as a threat to the status quo. Dr. Horn, what we're going to do, we're just going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll be talking about this whole history of vigilantism in the United States, the trials that are going on now, Charlottesville, the Rittenhouse trial, Ahmaud Arbery trial, and putting that also in a historic context. And we're also going to be on the international scene talking a bit about the U.S.-China relations. So stay with us. You won't want to miss anything that Dr. Gerald Horn has to say. Okay.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping though. Don't catch you slipping though. Look what I'm whipping though. This is America. Don't catch you slipping though. Don't catch you slipping though. Look what I'm whipping though. This is America. Don't catch you slipping though. Look how I'm living though. Police be tripping though. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area.
My area.
I got the strap. I gotta carry him.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're doing a one-hour in-depth special with Dr. Gerald Horn and a wide-ranging series of topics. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter at So True Radio, and we are nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Des Moines, Iowa, and internationally. Let's see, we have a list here. Right, let's give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Sweden. Well, who would have thunk, but yes, in Sweden. And our guest is Dr. Gerald Horn. And what we're going to do now is to go into a bit in depth about this whole history of vigilantism in the United States, but also these trials that are going on now that are really showing the manifestation of that in the United States today. Let's go to a clip. I want to play this clip on what happened in Charlottesville, where Heather Heyer was killed and a number of protesters injured by some white supremacists who were protesting there, because I think it really, in a lot of ways, shows clearly the context of the rest of what's happening with these other trials and race relations as they stand in the United States. Let's go to that clip.
A civil trial for organizers behind the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, is in its fourth week. 4 years ago, several right-wing groups marched through the streets of Charlottesville, protesting the removal of several Confederate monuments. Many carried tiki torches and violently clashed with counter-protesters. One person was killed and several others were hurt when a driver plowed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters. 10 plaintiffs are suing the organizers. They claim rioters violated their civil rights and caused them physical and emotional injuries during the demonstration. Defendants have argued there was no conspiracy leading up to the rally. They also say they had a First Amendment right to protest. Homeland Security and Justice reporter Nicole Skanga joins me now with more. Nicole, thanks very much for being with us. So the plaintiffs' attorneys have wrapped up their presentation of evidence. How are they attempting to depict an intentional planning of violence by the defendants ahead of that 2017 rally?
Well, Elaine, attorneys for the plaintiffs have really woven together a series of messages, social media posts, even podcasts to make their case for what is being called conspiracy to commit racially motivated violence during that deadly August weekend. And in some of these messages, participants describe the use of flagpole shields, even cars as weapons. Rally organizers and known white supremacists Jason Kessler and Richard Spencer, both defendants here, exchange messages about raising an army and the cracking of skulls if it comes to it. And plaintiffs' attorneys have presented evidence showing defendants bragging about violence, including video of Christopher Cantwell, one of the defendants here, a known neo-Nazi podcaster, displaying several guns that he brought with him to the rally. Earlier this week, attorneys even arguing that defendants instructed participants at the rally to mislead law enforcement, with Jason Kessler telling followers in a Facebook message, if police ask how many people you have coming, don't tell them. And Kessler went on to say he believed efforts would be thwarted if law enforcement thought more than 400 people were expected, even though organizers privately touted a number around 800 to 1,000 people. Now, there are 24 defendants here, including some of the country's most notorious white supremacists and leaders of long-established hate groups. But we also shouldn't lose sight of the plaintiffs, 9 current or former Charlottesville residents, including several former University of Virginia students who say they've endured both physical and emotional trauma, injuries as a result of the rally, and of course that torch-lit march you might remember you referenced earlier on UVA's campus the night before.
Well, Nicole, how are some of the defendants using the trial to further spread hateful messages?
Elaine, even though some of the defendants have been kicked off social media platforms like Facebook, some have found a new stage to amplify their racist views, and that is the trial itself. Hundreds of public citizens, journalists, plain old spectators dial in every day. I'm one of them. And, you know, the defendants radio, YouTube shows during the trial to give their take and purport their views. Up until a few days ago, defendant Jason Kessler had actually been messaging his followers from the courtroom in real time in a large group chat during the trial. trial, defendant Christopher Cantwell, who's representing himself, name-checked Hitler, used several racial slurs, and condemned Antifa activists within the first few minutes of his opening argument. And since, in several instances, defendants have participated in what's called doxing, publicly uncovering personal information about private citizens as they've cross-examined plaintiffs on the stand, it's something legal experts have called a really dangerous precedent.
Well, how could this verdict implicate former President Trump, Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani, and others who've been accused of inspiring violence ahead of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol?
So, Elaine, the civil rights organization Integrity First for America that's backing the nine plaintiffs here, they're actually using a 150-year-old statute called the Ku Klux Klan Act to try to hold defendants accountable here. And it was enacted back in 1871 and designed to protect African Americans following racial violence and terrorism in the South. But the Reconstruction-era law still has real utility today, and it could implicate former President Trump, his allies Steve Bannon, Rudy Giuliani, and others who have also been accused of inspiring violence, including racially motivated violence ahead of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. In fact, Capitol Police and lawmakers are actually relying on the very same statute to bring to bear their own civil lawsuits following January 6th. Elaine, I asked the executive director of Integrity First for America, Amy Spitalnik, about this when the trial first kicked off, and she called it sad that the KKK Act is having such a resurgence in the year of 2021. She said it's just one indication that violent extremism and white supremacy is also having a resurgence, but she said, you know, it's a reminder that it's time to take action for the group.
You know, Dr. Gerald Horn, it's interesting, you know, right at the end there where they're talking about the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act, but also, interestingly enough, saying that it's possible that that act could be used against the likes of Trump, Giuliani, and his ilk. We know that the jury begins deliberations in that trial going on in Charlottesville today involving those white supremacists that organized that rally in Charlottesville. But Dr. Horn, I played that clip because it really does set the stage, I think, for looking at what is happening with the other trials, with the Rittenhouse trial, with Ahmaud Arbery's trial, where race and racism and a big role in it, and the rise of militias across the United States, from Wisconsin to Texas, also guards in Florida prisons, and I imagine in other prisons that are all part of this ideology. So Dr. Horn, breaking that down a bit for us, I mean, the idea that a law from 1871 still has to be used today, Dr. Horn.
Well, I think it's appropriate for this law from the Reconstruction era, the post-1865 era, when black people were escaping slavery and seeking to be elected to office. However, their efforts were drowned in a tidal wave of blood spearheaded by the terrorists known as the Ku Klux Klan. And at that particular moment in history, the Ku Klux Klan was fundamentally the armed wing of the Democratic Party. Fast forward to 2021, and you see once again that these Klan-like elements are in motion, but now they're in a political and electoral coalition with the Republican Party. We say this because if you look at what's happened on January 6, 2021, with the attempt to prevent Donald Trump from leaving office, we know about the participation of these so-called alt-right formations, such as the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, etc. We know that there were many officers of the law, police officers, so-called retired military veterans, etc., who were disproportionately represented on January 6th. We also know about this movement that's gathering steam as we speak of so-called constitutional sheriffs. These are officers of the law who are sworn to ignore laws or enforcing laws they deem on their own to be improper or unconstitutional. These include all manner of laws, but of course, vaccine mandates are certainly within the crosshairs. Now, with regard to these trials that are going on, What's remarkable there, particularly about Charlottesville, it's once again the overlap between the establishment right wing and the so-called fringe right wing. For example, in August 2017 in Charlottesville, the Klansmen and the neo-Nazis were marching under the slogan of so-called replacement theory. They were chanting, "Jews will not replace us." This replacement theory has been duplicated and replicated on Fox News by Tucker Carlson, their chief spokesperson and commentator and pundit. And this idea is that the Democrats are somehow trying to transform the United States demographically by turning a blind eye, as the Republicans would argue, to people crossing the border and then recruiting these people crossing the border into an electoral block, a voting block, that then will somehow be used to replace the white working class and the white middle class. That is what is at stake with regard to the Charlottesville case, which once again helps to represent and reflect this devilish, diabolical alliance between these neo-Nazi forces and the Republican Party. Now, there is a ray of sunshine with regard to one of these trials. I'm thinking of the trial of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, which is taking place as we speak. Recall that he was the young black jogger who was chased down and killed vigilante style by latter-day lynchers. The good news is that Adam Wainwright, who happens to be white, he's a top athlete. He's a baseball pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team. He hails from Brunswick, Georgia. He came out yesterday in alignment and in solidarity with the black pastors who, you recall, were demonized by the defense lawyers who said that they should not be allowed to sit in the courtroom, speaking of Reverend Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend William Barber, et al. It's very important that this local hero stood in solidarity with the Arbery family, because even though, understandably, we make quite a to-do about Colin Kaepernick and other black athletes, there's been an eerie silence from many white athletes with regard to all of these pressing issues, and Adam Wainwright coming to the forefront is very significant and very important. Now, with regard to the trial in Kenosha, Wisconsin, of Kyle Rittenhouse, the teenage assassin who killed people in the wake of demonstrations protesting the police wounding severely of Jacob Blake, a black American man, also captured on tape, by the way, as was the Arbery slaying. What's interesting there is that the jury has been deliberating now for about 23 hours. It's difficult to interpret that. The most positive interpretation is that they're being painstaking as they march towards the conviction, although you never can be sure, certainly in light of the fact that the judge has been tipping the scales in favor of the defendant, is not reassuring in the least.
Yeah, absolutely not. And Dr. Horn, we really don't know what it all means. I mean, the judge, you know, in that case, you know, as you say, seemingly on the side of Kyle. And I was interested to also see some of the language, the coded language that these white supremacists are using, because they've taken off the sheets, right? And they're saying, well, we don't use, swastikas. Yeah, that's kind of like in the old days, but we use more coded language and things like the number 1488. Which refer to 14 words, which is a popular white supremacist slogan. And of course, H being the eighth letter of the alphabet, and that refers to that sign I don't want to repeat here, popping to Hitler. And then there's the phrase Rahowa, which sounds like, what are they talking about? Doesn't even make sense. But that stands for racial holy war. And also another thing that they do, did you see Kyle? And that actually is a play on words of the Nazi salute. So Dr. Horn, it just seems to me as though all of this is a thread running through not only all of these trials, the Charlottesville, Rittenhouse, and Ahmaud Arbery, but also, as you say, what happened on January 6th, and potentially what we may be facing in 2024. And Dr. Horn, before we go on to talk a bit about the international stuff, in particular, the U.S. tensions between the U.S. and China, you know, it does seem to be a very, very dangerous time right now, and people very, very worried about if we're already not in a state of fascism, of quickly moving in that direction. Just give us your thought on that, and then we'll move on to the international.
Well, I think it's striking what you are just referencing, all of these obscure acronyms and abbreviations. It points to a number of very troubling and disturbing factors. One, we already know about the penetration to the highest level of the Republican Party of the QAnon theorists. These are the folks such as Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Congresswoman Laura Boebert of Colorado, who have these fantastic, meaning fantasies, conspiracy theories about Democrats being Satanist pedophiles, for example. Recall that a man who was inspired by QAnon actually drove to Washington, D.C. and attacked a pizza shop which he thought housed these Satanist pedophiles. So this has to be taken quite seriously. And I think for those of us who are looking to historical analogies with regard to fascism, particularly in the 1930s, we recognize that in the 1930s, the fascists were not only on a path of irrationality, they were also dabbling in the occult. Many of them consider themselves to be highly religious, just like the latter-day fascists in the United States consider themselves to be highly religious. And what's remarkable as well is that on the one hand, they're dabbling in these conspiracy theorists. For example, here in the state of Texas, we were told that John F. Kennedy Jr., who we know died in a plane crash some years ago, was going to reemerge suddenly in North Texas, believe it or not. Of course, he did not reemerge, but that did not dampen the conspiracy theory. So at the same time that they're trafficking, that is to say the ultra-right and conspiracy theorists, they're trying to turn the rest of us into coincidence theorists. What I mean by that is we're not supposed to draw a connection between Jacob Blake and Ahmaud Arbery and Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Sandra Bland. We're not supposed to talk about systemic racism giving rise to these kinds of slayings, because that's supposedly critical race theory, which has been outlawed in a number of states. That is to say that we can only speak of all of these incidents as coincidence, whereas the right wing is able to dabble in the most absurd conspiracy theories. There's something wrong with that picture. And I think also I would be remiss if I failed to mention, as we get ready to segue into global events, that the U.S. left made some serious miscalculations as well. The U.S. left historically has spoken of what they see as the deep democratic traditions of the United States of America, which is remarkable when you consider it took the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was preceded by bloodiness all over the country just to get the right to vote for a number of black citizens. And yet, supposedly, we have these deep democratic traditions. Obviously, that was a misguided miscalculation. And I'm afraid to say that in 2021 and 2022, chickens may come home to roost, to cite the fabled phrase of the aforementioned Malcolm X.
Right. And on that note, just a couple of pieces of relatively good news here. Well, good news for Julius Jones, who was the black man in Oklahoma who was on death row, and so many people rose up asking the governor not to move ahead with his killing, state killing of Julius Jones. And in fact, they have had some success in that. So that has been great. You know, his case had a lot of widespread attention, including a documentary called The Last Defense. But students in Oklahoma, you know, were walking out, high school students, university students. It was really a massive movement not to kill this man. And then just this morning, despite the efforts of Republican leader of the House, Kevin McCarthy, who gave a speech of over 8 hours yesterday trying to block a vote on President Biden's Build Back Better plan that has the child tax credits and resources for home care workers and other caregiver care and a whole set of other things, that passed this morning. So just wanted to report that for Dr. Horn. Now moving on to this summit that happened between President Xi of China and President Biden on Monday, November 18th. There have not happened, but no breakthroughs, but a joint statement. And I wonder if you want to give your thoughts on this, you know, the United States doing this delicate balance with China that is growing as an economic, growing as the military, and the United States making a lot about the human rights abuses attributed to the worry that people of Taiwanese descent have in terms of what China might do in relation to Taiwan, given the crackdown that happened in Hong Kong. And one has to wonder if China and President Xi, on the other hand, are raising some of the human rights abuses that we've just been talking about here in the United States. But your thoughts on the relations and how you saw the summit, Dr. Horn.
Well, obviously, relations between the United States and China are at a very dangerous point. You may recall that in the summit between the leaders of Mexico, Canada, and the United States, just at the White House in the last 24 hours, in an offhanded fashion, Mr. Biden mentioned that the United States may officially boycott the Winter Olympics, which are slated to jump off in China within a few months. Now, this will not involve keeping U.S. athletes away. It will mean there will be no official U.S. delegation. I don't think that that will be a step forward in terms of improving the relationship, which is obviously headed towards a precipitous decline. You may also recall that in the best-selling book by Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward and Robert Costa of the Washington Post, Carol, about the last days of the Trump regime, the book opens with a frightening scene of Mr. Trump supposedly recommending a military strike against China so that he could declare a state of emergency and hang on to power. Therein, you also see the close connection between the domestic and the global, that is to say, manufacturing an international crisis to hold on to power domestically. Obviously, that did not go down very well in China. And then just a few weeks ago, you had the chief U.S. military officer, Mark Milley, who suggested that the United States may have reached the so-called Sputnik moment, referring to Moscow launching a satellite in outer space in 1957, which sent chills of apprehension coursing down the spine of leaders in Washington. China supposedly had just launched the so-called hypersonic missile, which was thought to be able to evade U.S. Anti-ballistic missile defenses. And so this relation is heading south, but I think it's important for the audience to understand how we got to this point. And we got to this point as a result of a deal that was brokered a half century ago between the U.S. and Chinese leaderships on an anti-Soviet basis, whereby in return for China deepening its hostility to the then Soviet Union, the United States would then direct massive foreign direct investment into China. That has created this juggernaut in China, which is leading the world in terms of artificial intelligence, which may be the key technology of the future, also leading the world in terms of green energy, particularly solar energy. And so now the United States wants to reverse that deal brokered a half century ago, up to and including a military assault on China. And I should also say, with regard to the human rights question in China, One of the burning issues today is what has happened to the Chinese tennis player Peng Shuai, who charged a leader of the Chinese Communist Party with various sexual indiscretions. She has not appeared in public of late. That has caused a flurry of outcry from tennis giants such as Serena Williams, Naomi Osaka, not to mention other tennis champions such as Billie Jean King. And that too will be an issue going forward when the United States decides if and when it will boycott the Winter Olympics in China.
Right, and also, thank you for that, Dr. Horn. On the international front, just a couple of minutes left, actually about a minute and a half, I wondered if you wanted to comment on the demand Global South are making now of countries of the Global North to say, hey, you all got to pay up for all of what we need to do to stop the destruction of the environment in our areas, when it is the Global North doing most of the polluting, and similarly indigenous lands here in the United States and also south of the border, and Black communities such as Cancer Alley down in Louisiana. Just a quick thought on this kind of reparatory justice when it comes to the environment. Dr. Horn, final thoughts.
Well, that kind of justice is what we need right now to save this small planet on which we reside. I should also mention that this idea of climate reparations should be taken up and adopted by the reparations movement in the United States of America, that is to say reparations to the descendants of the enslaved in North America, because joining with the climate reparations movement can only put wind in their sails. And I should also mention as well that given all of this hysteria about refugees, recall what has been happening until late on the border between Belarus and Poland with regard to refugees, what's been happening on the Texas-Mexico border with regard to refugees. Well, we have not seen anything compared to what might happen as the seas continue to rise and as the climate continues to strike back, which will drive people from small island states, will drive people from Africa northward, perhaps into Europe. So it seems to me that the wisest course going forward is precisely climate reparations.
Absolutely. On that note, Dr. Horn, the time just flew. Thank you so very much for joining us today. Just fascinating. Dr. Horn, but we are out of time, so I've got to get out of here. Today's show produced by me, that's Morgan Flashdown. I want to thank Mark Maxwell for coming in and helping us out with our engineer crisis this morning. Thank you, Mark. Our assistant producer, Romero Funes. You all please remember to stay safe. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Just talking about it and talking about the story of how these people regarded the indigenous people as the devil incarnate, just logically, would they really be sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner with people they consider the devil, these true believers? I don't think so. If there were any Native people there, they would probably have been enslaved.
That's Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on the other side of Thanksgiving. The historical lens through which national holidays are viewed is often blurred and distorted. Thanksgiving is a case in point. The much-revered pilgrims, fresh off the